Welcome, welcome to Paradigm Shifters. My name is Veronica Entwistle, and we like to talk to people who are kind of cruising on the edges of consciousness and teaching us a lot as they go. And we're going to talk to Daniel Pinchbeck, whose latest book is called When Plants Dream. And Daniel, you've written about ayahuasca, shamanism, and the global, this part is fascinating, the global psychedelic renaissance. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, what is your history? How come you're doing this amazing work?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. I'm 53 years old. I was a journalist in my 20s and edited a literary magazine. In my late 20s, I had kind of a classic like spiritual emergency or existential crisis. I remembered that I explored psychedelic substances like LSD and mushrooms in college. So I decided to go back in and explore them. And then I ended up getting assignments as a journalist to go to West Africa and Burning Man and the Amazon and in Ecuador.
Wow.
And that led to my first book, Breaking Open the Head, which was, kind of like looking into all of the visionary plants and psychedelics used around the world, looking into the traditional cultures and how they use them, and also kind of thinking about why modern industrial civilization had kind of suppressed the visionary experience and, these other types of consciousnesses that you can, kind of access through these plants.
Actually, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I'll just interrupt you for a sec, but just to say, sure. Why are we suppressed is really just an interesting question in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if we go back historically, it's like the European culture and consciousness developed in such a way. We had the Inquisition in the Middle Ages, and a lot of witches were burned at stake. What we call witches were actually the people in those cultures who possessed plant knowledge, who worked with, native visionary plants, who possessed second sight and had access to the visionary experience. Because with the rise of Christianity, the only people who are supposed to have access to anything, sacred or divine or, elevated were the priests, in the religion, the hierarchical priests. Mm-hmm. So if anybody else had these natural abilities to see into other worlds, that was seen as bad. And so they were, killed or ostracized or whatever.
One of the things that I muse about while you're saying all that, I'm going, well, isn't it interesting that way back before humans developed these systems, there was still the wisdom, wasn't there? There was still the plants, there were still spirits and so on. So I guess it is kind of civilization that daunts it, just for the sake of if I have it, then you don't, right?
There are many reasons. I mean, our, Anglo-European civilization in the modern period became very focused on, rationality, reason, technology, kind of the left brain, the masculine aspects of consciousness. And so we demonized and repressed, the intuitive and the visionary domains and areas that are maybe, traditionally considered as more feminine. And what we see in the 20th and 21st century with the rediscovery of psychedelics and, meditation and yoga, it's kind of like the return of the repressed into the modern psyche and into the contemporary European civilization.
It's kind of like diving into your brain, eh? Talk about your first book, sorry.
Basically, as many people discover when they try, mushrooms or LSD or ayahuasca, there's a much bigger range of possible consciousness experiences. And our society really only privileges a very narrow range of consciousness, what it takes to, work for a living, what it takes to, kind of like the trance you might get into a video game or watching a movie or something. And these other dimensions have been lost, to a large extent. But, luckily now, with kind of the psychedelic renaissance, they're coming back. So that was kind of my first book. It came out in 2002.
And what was it called again?
It was kind of, that book was called Breaking Open the Head, a psychedelic journey into the heart of contemporary shamanism.
Hmm.
And I visited tribal indigenous groups in Gabon in West Africa, in the Amazon in Ecuador, and in Oaxaca in Mexico. and then also wrote about kind of modern psychedelics like LSD and MDMA and scientists and chemists and festivals, you know, that have a psychedelic theme like Burning Man and so on. So that book was a big voyage of discovery for me. And then I wrote a second book that was called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, that was really looking at the knowledge systems of these indigenous cultures like the Hopi in Arizona and the Aztecs and the Maya in Mesoamerica, and recognizing that a lot of them believe that we this is now a very critical transformational time, which they talk about in various ways. And I was really trying to understand what these indigenous cultures understood about the time that we're in. And yeah, kind of like...
And do they believe that this is the time? Do they really think that this is the time that we're going to transform?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, universally kind of obvious at this point, you know, particularly if we look at what's happening, you know, ecologically with the, you know, climate crisis and, the, you know, the rapid evolution of technology and now all these kind of, you know, really kind of scary geopolitical things that are happening around the world. So, yeah, somehow, you know, even from hundreds or, you know, maybe longer, thousands of years ago, they understood that this time was like a transition into something else. Or maybe the end of time as we currently understand it, what's possible too.
So your book is called When Plants Dream. So of course the obvious question
is,
oh, do you have a book in between the one you spoke of?
Yes. The second book was 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Okay. Right.
And, then there was another more recent book that came out a few years ago called How Soon Is Now? And that book was more focused on the environmental crisis, which I look at kind of from a shamanic perspective as a kind of rite of passage or like journey of initiation for humanity as a whole, as a collective. And then I try to envision the types of changes we have to make to our technical and social systems if we want to really reckon with what we've shifted in the biosphere itself.
I think it's interesting, the current book, following along, you've done this amazing pathway using kind of the brain and our potential and its rapport with life, but this one called When Plants Dream, and I was also, I was really struck when you said basically that they might be creating us instead of us being in charge or being top dog, that they might actually be leading the way. And I kind of thought of back into your other books. Do you think that's what's been leading you all the way through, is the beckoning from the spirit beings of all life in a greater level?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's quite possible. You know, it's quite possible that, you know, everything that's playing out now is actually, you know, has a larger evolutionary purpose or teleology. I mean, you know, on the joking side, you have a comedian like George Carlin who believed that, you know, humans were going to, you know, wipe ourselves out pretty soon. And that probably we just, you know, the Earth needed us to create plastics. You know, so now there's lots of plastic around, you know, the Earth can get rid of humans and create something else, you know.
Well, he did a lot of drugs too. So he knew some of that too from the inside, right?
I suppose I don't know anything about his drug habits, but he was a very funny guy.
Very funny. Hilarious, yeah. Yeah. And I believe that he had consciousness, yeah.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, many people, when they explore visionary plants like ayahuasca or peyote or, you know, even chemicals like LSD or whatever, do get a sense that... there's like a larger cosmological puzzle, and that actually underlying it is like, you know, something truly benevolent that really is seeking to bring out our, you know, deepest potential. Mm-hmm. But that happens slowly and over you know, vast epochs of time.
I think also that there's a kind of a movement of consciousness through humanity or through civilization through the centuries, because I'm older than you, and the 60s was such a big deal, and we all felt something was awakening then, and I'm sure there have been many, many times in history like that. But this time is what would we say, more inclusive. It's worldwide and it's beyond, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is kind of, you know, in a way that, you know, I hate to say it, but kind of like an end game. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I
don't hate to say it, you know, because it's got to be the end of something. We know that. It has to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But on the one hand, you have, you know, very powerful corporations that are controlled, you know, by people who seem to be kind of sociopathic, who are just, you know, hell-bent on short-term earnings and quarterly profits. And, you know, they're doing things that, you know, every scientist in the world is screaming, you know, out, saying that if you keep drilling in the Arctic and, you know, keep doing, you know, what we're doing, you know, keep burning the forests, you know, it'll have tremendously negative consequences. And many, many people will suffer. And often the ones who don't get the benefit of the goods and the services that come from, you know, the technologies.
But why do you think they won't listen? Because I keep thinking, well, if it's all about money and it all ends, where do they put that money? Where do they get it? And how do they spend it anyway, right?
I've actually been having a series of talks with people about that.
Oh,
good. And I think that one problem is that if you're a big winner, a beneficiary of the system, if you're, you know, a multimillionaire or a billionaire, you know, you're, it's very hard for you not to think that everything is kind of working out. You know, because you've won the game, you know, you're at the top of the game and the game was totally designed, you know, for you and you won it. And that's that creates a psychological pattern that makes it very difficult for you to reckon with the reality that, you know, these types of changes that are coming are going to impact, you know, everybody on Earth, including you and your family, you know.
But also the planet itself, right?
But I mean, I think a lot of the people who are at the top of these pyramids are very much trained to be, you know, self-interested above all.
Mm-hmm. This is taking it to a different level, and I'll shift the subject somewhat. But there's a section near the beginning, actually, of this one. I think this is a life-changing book, frankly, for everybody to get to it. When Plants Dream, it's just really something. But in one area, you were talking about the Amazonian, how they handle the soil in the Amazon. You know, we're always talking about they're burning down, blah, blah, blah. But you've got this whole section on ecology there. I want to talk to people about that because that was very impressive. About a kind of an ash that's created.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it turns out that we're learning that all around the planet, the indigenous people, you know, really have this very refined reciprocal relationship with the, you know, local environment, with the earth. And in many cases, this had developed over hundreds or thousands of years. And they developed various sophisticated tools and, you know, technologies that allowed them to, you know, really make sure the earth around them was fertile and kept producing and so on. So it turns out that, you know, the soil of the Amazon jungle is very fragile, but indigenous groups would actually enhance it through a process called terra preta, where they would slow burn organic material in a way that would create kind of like a carbon-rich tilth. And then they could, you know, kind of spread this carbon around to enhance the fertility of the soil.
Wow.
So that's just one of a number of methods that indigenous people used around the world.
They've already done it for thousands of years, huh?
It's quite possible, yeah.
I just thought it was delightful to read that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's always hard to tell with Amazonian cultures because the jungle is such a, you know, fertile, you know, beast that there never is any much trace going back more than like, you know, 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Before then, you have to kind of just extrapolate or imagine what these cultures were like.
Hmm. So let's jump around. I find that fascinating. Thank you for that. Let's jump around a little bit and talk about When Plants Dream, for example, which is the name of your book. But there's a lot of information that comes from plants and teaches people how to use them or how to grow. Do you think there's a symbiotic nature with the transcendence of our consciousness? You don't have to go that far, but, you know, it's really educational.
I do think, I mean, well, first of all, you know, as for instance, like Michael Pollan wrote about, you know, we think that we are gardening plants, but what if the plants really garden us? You know, what if like the tomato plant or the marijuana plant is actually using us to develop its genome and reproduce, you know.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have these other specific plants that if you take them, you can have this profound visionary experience, like psilocybin mushrooms or peyote, San Pedro, or ayahuasca. And who's to say that that's, you know, accidental? It may be that those plants are chose to create those compounds to have this kind of interaction with us.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear plants yourself?
Can I hear them? Every now and then I have a conversation with an elm tree or something, but it's pretty rare.
Well, and I'm not laughing at you. I'm just going, it sounds funny to say that, but actually plants do communicate a lot. I know they do. And so how did people find out what, it's gone down through centuries, hasn't it? What kind of plants do what, right?
I'm not really a botanist like that. So I don't know if I can really answer that question, but you know, in terms of the ayahuasca, it's very interesting because, ayahuasca is a vine. So basically when you use the word ayahuasca, you're referring to a potion that's made from two plants.
Okay.
At least two plants that are brewed together for a long time. And one of them is called the ayahuasca vine or Banisteriopsis coppi. And it grows these thick double helices. It's a very interesting vine. But that one isn't very psychoactive. It's only when you mix it with the leaves of this plant called Psychotria viridis that contained dimethyltryptamine or DMT, which we've also found to be a naturally occurring chemical in our own brains, that it creates a very, very powerful psychoactive or visionary effect. So we really don't know how these indigenous groups in the Amazon, you know, could have figured out, you know, how, you know, to brew these plants together for many hours. You have to acidify it, so you have to add some other, you know, kind of compound or something. So it is quite extraordinary. And, you know, the indigenous cultures have their myths about it. And, you know, some of the shamans, you know, will also say that way back when, you know, the plants appeared to them in dreams and taught their ancestors how to use them and so on. But it's quite a mystery.
Oh, well, that sort of makes sense, though. It is a kind of a communication, isn't it? I think as I was reading the book, I'm going, I'm really excited about the fact, let me see now. We could be facing end times. We know that. That's not a happy thing for me, except that there is something about life right now which can absolutely shift how we think and see and can, absolutely change things. You know that, and I know that. You know, what will it take? And reading your book, I'm going, huh, maybe this is part of the deal here. What do you think?
Going back to the 60s, you know, when Timothy Leary, who was a Harvard psychologist, and Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, you know, discovered, you know, first psilocybin and then LSD and then, you know, the Beats like Allen Ginsberg and Ken Kesey and so on, then started to explore it. That was really the big hope, that it was a very powerful deprogramming agent that could really make people aware of all the layers of conditioning that they had been subjected to, and then really, you know, respond more directly to the world around them. And, you know, you saw that influence in the Green Movement, the Back to the Land Movement, and so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that we see more psychedelics becoming kind of popular again, even moving towards legality in some cases, you know, that would be the hope, is that they're providing that kind of experience that's going to open people's eyes and let them, you know, deal with the world in a more original way. Because, you know, yeah, we often get, many people get sort of indoctrinated by the media and by education, and they're really taught to only look at the world in one way.
So I was just curious as to, before we get too far into the ayahuasca, you were speaking about this amazing journey you've done going over to Africa and these different places which have their own cultural ceremonial medicines, if they're called that. And I wondered, first of all, can you make any kind of comparison, or was it always the same, or where did you learn the most, and was it hard for you to break into their private ceremonial realms? Can you talk a bit about that? That must have been quite an adventure.
Yeah, I mean, You know, obviously, that's a lot of the book that I wrote, so it's hard to condense all those questions into a quick answer.
Yeah.
You know, every culture had you know, profound similarities and also profound differences. It was extraordinary the way each culture had kind of built its, you know, relationship to the spirit world and sort of other aspects of its music and ceremony around these particular plants, you know. So the Iboga in Africa, they would do this drumming, and that one lasts very, very long, like 15 or 20 hours. So it's like a very, very long ceremony.
Wow.
You know, the Sequoia, you know, in Ecuador, this tribe that we visited, the community, indigenous community we stayed with in the jungle there, you know, they had a ceremonial lodge. We would lie in hammocks and they would sing all night, and you would kind of see these different visions as they sang. And they seemed to really have a profound knowledge of how these, you know, songs combined with the plants would sort of guide you through these different visionary experiences. So, yeah, I mean, they were amazing. I really feel very, very grateful, you know, to the universe to allow me to, you know, have had these experiences. And then also, even after the books, I helped organize some retreats. So I got to work with some other groups like the Kogi in Colombia, the Kogi and the Arawak people, who don't actually use any, they don't use anything that has a psychedelic compound. Their sacred medicine is the coca leaf.
Oh.
And their, a lot of their society is kind of built around this communion with Mama Coca, which is totally different than cocaine. You know, they take it just as the pure leaf. So that was a whole different culture that had built itself around. I mean, a great book, you know, I mean, I definitely obviously recommend Breaking Open the Head, but One River by Wade Davis mm-hmm. is a very beautiful book where he follows Richard Schultes, who's an ethnobotanist who worked with a lot of indigenous cultures in South America and really documented how intermeshed their sacred culture was with these different visionary plant medicines.
Hmm. I wonder if we can include a lot of, and I want to get more into the ayahuasca in a minute, but I was just thinking if we can include the, for example, the acid, acid dropping, that kind of thing over here as a ceremonial connector between people, as if it was a tribe, you know what I mean? Or is it just too commercial?
Yeah, I mean, that's a long and complicated conversation also. I mean, you know, LSD was only discovered in 1943. It was popular after the Second World War. A chemist, Albert Hofmann, discovered it in a very interesting way. You know, it feels, you know, sometimes it would seem as if that was also, you know, had a historical meaning and that it inspired like some of the great movements of the 60s. And there was a, you know, big psychedelic, you know, psychic amplifier and, you know, led to all sorts of, you know, great and amazing and also sometimes terrible things. Mm-hmm. You know, music festivals, you know, are in a way our version of these kind of ritual spaces where people commune together, you know, and, you know, sometimes people also do it out in nature. I mean, also, you know, the access to these substances has been very restricted legally mm-hmm. In that, you know, in the mid 60s, psychedelics were made illegal. They were made Schedule I compounds, you know, even though, you know, a few years earlier, you know, many of the best and brightest minds of our society had been saying that, you know, these were the most important tools for understanding the human mind that we'd ever found.
Mm-hmm.
The fear around the social unrest that they were causing and the turbulence in the society that, you know, led them to be demonized and outlawed. And it's only now that that's beginning to change and to thaw. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of very exciting work happening. For instance, in England, there's the Imperial College of London is doing all these amazing studies, looking at what happens to people's brains when they take, you know, psychedelics like LSD and DMT. They can see that, you know, all these different areas of the brain that are normally inactive light up and communicate in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this group called MAPS in the U.S. is also doing amazing work. And they're at the moment doing phase 3 clinical trials using MDMA, which is known as ecstasy, mm-hmm. as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And they're finding that these are veterans who have, you know, treatment-averse forms of PTSD. So they've tried all these different therapies and nothing has worked. But they're finding that when they take MDMA in a therapy, they have like a 60% cure rate of the PTSD in just 3 sessions.
Oh, wow. So, that is really big news. Yeah. So there's medicinal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a lot. And we talked about it in the book also. There's a whole section on it. I mean, you know, ayahuasca is also being used for PTSD. In fact, there's a new documentary out called From Shock to Awe, which follows a bunch of Iraq war veterans who, you know, go and work with ayahuasca and end up, you know, throwing away all of their pills. They're totally, you know, clean. I mean, you know, complex issue in our society is we've become very dependent on these, you know, psychopharmacological tools, and they're very big profit centers for, you know, major pharmaceutical corporations.
Sure.
And you know, the ways that psychedelics help people, it's like you don't give somebody, you know, mushrooms every week or every day or LSD. It's like they take them maybe once or twice or 3 times. They have a cathartic kind of self-realization and healing, and then that's kind of it. They don't necessarily need these substances again. So, you know, the you know, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, they all fit well into the sort of corporate capitalist paradigm, because they get people hooked on these substances, whereas these psychedelics don't really have that same, you know, benefit for corporations, you know. So,
and do people come down to... Do people come down to South America and do ayahuasca for the sake of healing, for medicine, as well as just for personal expansion?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We talk about that in the book. I talk about one friend of mine who had, I don't know if he had stage 3 cancer, and he feels that working with ayahuasca in Peru, along with other plants, with some master shamans down there, he was able to really... you know, kind of, yeah, somehow not only heal physically, but also kind of wake up his spirit and heal his spiritual disease and come back to the world with a totally new view on reality. And that's very common. There's, you know, many, many stories like that.
I love that, actually. What about you? Are you able to share a story, or if you're willing to share a personal story about something you've experienced, maybe when you first started or something like that, so people know what it's all about?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, when I first took the Saboga, which is the African psychedelic from Gabon, which I write about in my books, Breaking Open the Head in 2012, you know, it was a very long experience, but it was a very psychologically intense one where, for a lot of it, I mean, for a while I had like visions with my eyes open, but a lot of the time I was lying down, they were playing this music, and I was seeing kind of all these scenes from my early life, like these holograms where I could enter and see like how my, you know, when my parents were fighting when I was a kid, how that affected me, and, you know, illnesses that I'd had as a child, how they affected me. And, I saw alcohol, how as a guy in my 20s in the New York art literary worlds, when I was, you know, drinking, how that was having a really bad effect on my character and so on. So that changed me. It made me you know, cut down on drinking, although I didn't, you know, totally cut it out, unfortunately, probably. And also just realize that you know, even when we're conditioned by things in the past, if we can really understand our conditioning, we can break out of it.
So it sounds like what happens is our brain, we have access to more parts of our brain, so we can, include different qualities, different potentials, would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still in the learning phases of all of this. I mean, we know that with MDMA, it really boosts serotonin, which is a, you know, chemical that makes us feel really, you know, good and strong and, you know, feel a lot of love and so on. So when you have a serotonin boost, then you can deal with, like, you know, suppressed images and memories maybe of, you know, that would cause trauma and stress. So those can come up to the surface and you can actually kind of process them, you know, more objectively without them, you know, feeling so threatening.
So they're giving that to some of the vets, right?
That's the one that's in phase 3 clinical trials and may actually be legal for treatment in a couple of years.
So what about giving some of this stuff to some of our politicians?
Yeah, people always ask that, but I actually don't think it would really help, to be honest, because
they could resist.
You know, it's you sort of, you know, the psychedelics could be called non-specific psychic amplifiers, so they kind of take whatever is in your head and then they amp it up, you know. Mm. So, you know, if these people are thinking really negative thoughts and are kind of, you know, broken in some deep way, it's you know, it may not actually make them better people. It may just make them more scared.
I'm glad you said that, because it's nice to have a fantasy that all they need is a good hit of this or that, you know.
I don't have that fantasy.
Yeah, I can tell, actually. So it's not just a simple antidote for evolutional problems, right? So let me see, what else? The other tools. Okay, the law. One of the things that happens with humanity, and you know this, is we get stuck in the rules of religion and law and all of that. I think, and I'm making this up, I don't know. I've only had one acid trip my whole life, and it was a long time ago, but I still tap it. But the thing I'm thinking is that how it would impact the grip of religion on people, it must be liberating, do you think?
Well, we have a whole section on religion in the book. I mean, one thing that often happens is when people come from a religious background, whether they're like active participants or not, they often see images that are from that background, or even scenes. Like a friend of mine who's from an Islamic background had a vision of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
A friend from a Hindu background from India saw kind of like the different Hindu gods, like the Hanuman and so on. And in fact, there are a couple of religions that use what's basically ayahuasca as their sacrament. That started in Brazil back in the 1920s and 30s. And essentially what happened is, you know, the mestizos who had been, you know, steeped in Catholicism and so on, would get jobs, patrolling the borders of the Amazon or working as rubber tappers. And they would make friends with the local indigenous people. They would drink ayahuasca with them, but they would see their visions with a kind of Christian overlay. And so this actually led to new religions developing. One is called Uno de Vegetalis, and one is called Santo Daime.
Hmm.
These are the two most well-known ones. And those religions bring together kind of indigenous animism, you know, with Christian iconography and beliefs.
Hmm.
So you might have a set of hymns where the Virgin Mary is actually the mother of the forest, and so on.
Oh, wow. Well, that seems like it would be okay. I suppose it could go the other way as well. But then it makes me think that do people seem to love themselves better when they've gone through these experiences?
Generally, you know, the first few times you do it, you know, particularly with ayahuasca, which also has a natural antidepressant, the Banisteria spiscapi or ayahuasca vine contains beta-carbolines, which are natural MAO inhibitors. So generally, you know, after the experience, you're in a very, very good state, and you feel forgiveness and love towards yourself and other people. You feel a strong feeling of healing, and it often creates a very positive affect towards yourself and the world around you.
Well, you hear that, where that's coming from in me, because I'm going, well, maybe it is a big tool for the transcendence of the collective.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's for everybody. I mean, it's for people who have a calling towards it. I mean, you know, in Amazonian cultures, you know, it varied from culture to culture, but often it would really only be the sort of self-chosen few who would feel the need to go through these deep initiatory journeys. And often, actually, in those cultures, it would only be the shaman who would drink ayahuasca, and then while he was in an altered state, he would perform healings or exorcisms or whatever needed to be done. So, and also another issue is that, it's not clear that there's enough medicine for everybody right now, particularly with Iboga. There's scarcity issues. In fact, my co-author on the book When Plants Dream Sophia Rocklin is an anthropologist in Peru. And one of the things that she's doing right now is she's coordinating for a new nonprofit that is basically helping local indigenous communities sustainably grow and harvest ayahuasca for the future, for the world market. Because it takes 5 to 10 years for a vine to really grow to the point where, it's accessible, that it's mature enough to be used. So it requires sort of long-term coordination and planning. And at the moment, because it became such a cash crop down there, people are just growing it, going into the forest and chopping down the old vines. And, it's not a very good situation.
We're so ruthless sometimes, aren't we, as a species, right?
Well, we're very ruthless. I mean, look what's happening all around the earth right now. Look what's happening to the Amazon in Brazil. It's being burned down for soybean plantations, to grow more cattle.
And what happens to the planet if that all gets chopped down? Isn't it very, very dangerous for everyone? Everyone?
Yeah, we're probably all going to die because of this. Because, not only does the Amazon produce a lot of our oxygen, it also has a major effect on the climate, on the atmosphere, on the moisture in the atmosphere. So, as we lose the forests, whether in the Arctic or Indonesia or the Amazon or California, we're also losing the whole system that, keeps the climate in a kind of moist homeostatic balance. So then we have more droughts and that'll lead to more famines and so on. So yeah, this is incredibly short-sighted what human beings are doing right now. But we're kind of in the inertia of the system, and we don't really seem to know how to stop ourselves.
No, I don't think we do. I think a lot of us really care, and we don't know what to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, one movement that I'm quite fond of. Actually, today there's climate strikes happening all over the planet.
Mm-hmm. And, there's a huge one today all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have gone in March, but I recently broke my leg, so I'm still on crutches, so it's not a good time for me to march. But I think that some of these movements are very, very profound. If people want to find an active way to get involved, Extinction Rebellion is a very good movement.
What is it called? Extinction Rebellion?
Extinction Rebellion, yeah, rebellion against our possible extinction. And they're using a model of nonviolent civil disobedience, trying to get large groups of people to get arrested, to force governments to move much faster on addressing climate change and cutting down fossil fuel emissions. So then in April, I think they had weeks of protest in London. They shut down a number of bridges and over 1,000 people got arrested. And that actually led to the government of England declaring climate emergency. So next month, Extinction Rebellion is having a whole set of new protests. And the idea is to really now force the government to make policy, around that declaration. But this is something that anybody can get involved with, anywhere they are. They can start their own group, or they can look to see if there is a group.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up. Extinction Evolution, right?
No. Extinction Rebellion.
Extinction Rebellion. Okay. That's
Extinction
really.
Exactly.
What's her name? What's the young woman from Sweden? What's her name? Gretchen? No, not Gretchen.
Oh, Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, she's in Congress, I think, right now.
I think you're right. Yeah, yep. which is extraordinary. I mean, it's somehow she's become the poster girl for the whole movement.
And that's really great. Anybody who sees her a picture goes, well, yeah, that's what we have to be after. So that's pretty effective, isn't it?
Yes, there is a problem though that we often encounter, which is the way things often work is when people see a leader in a field, they think that somebody is taking care of it, and therefore they don't feel that they have to do something on their own, which is totally the counter to what her message is, which is basically that we're in this really dire emergency right now, and everybody has to, do their part. And many people in the U.S. obviously are still confused because there's been so much
distraction.
Distraction, but also climate change denial that often ultimately comes from the fossil fuel companies, which have actually spent a huge amount of money to foment distraction and make denial plausible. So you know, it's very interesting. If I, you know, talk about this stuff on like Facebook or whatever, I'll still get many, many people who'll be like, climate change is a myth and it's not really happening.
But, wow, you know, I can't believe that. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible, isn't it? We have the melting.
Yeah. Well, you have hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know, from the oil companies, you know, going into propaganda.
And you've got a lot of people who don't want to believe it because it's too painful, right? And that makes it easy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
One of the things I do as a Pollyanna kind of figure is I keep thinking, well, with the kind of things you're teaching us about, for example, ayahuasca or all these different ceremonial things around the world, it really evokes in people an attunement to spirit. And I think that includes, as we already talked about it, love and so on. And I keep going that maybe that will shift, that will increase the rate of the shift so that we will move collectively into a more compassionate with plants and animals reality. What do you think of that?
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it's just part of the whole picture. I realize it's a bit airy-fairy, but, you know, on the other hand, everything's got to come together on this. So medicine, you were talking, I was going to ask you about other medicines. So there was a section of the book where you were talking about how I think it's the frontal lobe of the brain doesn't get fully engaged or doesn't get activated unless there's a kind of a shock partway along. Do you remember that part of the book?
Yeah. I was talking about, it's a whole idea that I really love, that different writers have talked about, including Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote a book called The Biology of Transcendence.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read that. Sounds good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very nice. I mean, you can see some nice videos of him online, but yeah, that, you know, the prefrontal cortex is the new part of the brain that marks us as humans, and it allows us to, you know, process symbols and plan for the future, but it also separates us, you know, it often alienates us into a kind of egocentric, you know, identity. Mm. And you know, that seems to be the reason why these traditional cultures had rites of passage or initiation that often involved, you know, people going through these, you know, kind of harrowing experiences, whether they were walkabouts or, you know, ayahuasca or, different types of things like that, fasting and so on. Mm-hmm. It's like they would, you know, do what they could to push these people into a visionary state, like a transpersonal state.
A stress level. Kind of
like activate the whole brain. And so then you become less focused on, you know, your own little existence, and you step into the adult responsibility, you know, for the community as a whole.
It's kind of like a near-death experience sort of thing.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting. And I was wondering about, like, for example, the vets. I wonder if some of what they have gone through in their tours of duty, would that function as that? Because it seems to more destroy them, doesn't it? It's a bit different,
yeah,
I suppose.
I think it's just very psychologically traumatizing to be in these battle zones, you know, to be forced to, you know, defend yourself from being killed or to kill other people. You know, most people will bend and ultimately crack under that type of pressurized experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're almost near the end. So if somebody's listening and they want to get involved and they want to take a run at this, what do you indicate or what do you suggest is the best route, the safest route? How do people connect with doing all this?
When you say all this,
I mean exactly taking ayahuasca or getting involved in a ceremonial awakening.
Yeah.
You know, I would call it an awakening ceremony.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so, you know, ayahuasca is still in kind of like a gray area of legal limbo right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's some of these religions have won protection to, you know, hold their ceremonies using the medicine. And for a number of years, I don't think anyone has been, you know, arrested in the U.S. for, you know, putting out the medicine, the ayahuasca. So, you know, but still there's a kind of underground culture around it. So, you know, people would have to connect, you know, find that culture in their own community, in their own home. Then they're also, you know, the experiences are legal in Peru or Costa Rica, you know, and they can look at many different retreat centers. You know, they can read reports from people who've been to those retreat centers. I mean, it's kind of like
look for where it's legal.
Like a very, it's legal in most of South America, like Peru and I believe Colombia and even Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so so yeah.
So to head in those places where you can deal with the questions because you know it's legal there anyway, right?
That's one possibility. You know, then there's a sort of underground world of curanderos or shamans who are coming through the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on where you live or how far you want to travel, you know, there's, you know, different ways to connect with that. But that's not really like my, you know, I'm not really an expert on that. It's kind of up to the individual to do their work there.
But this book is really informative and it has a whole lot more than we've had time to talk about today. But what's next, Daniel? What are you going to do after this?
Well, at the moment, I'm beginning to. I actually wrote a play, which I'm having a reading of on Tuesday.
Oh, good.
I wrote a short book on UFOs and aliens, which I just self-published, called The Occult Control System. And,
do you think they're going to save us, Daniel?
I think they're going to save us. I think it's complex. I mean, that would be subject for another long interview. But
good.
The book, The Occult Control System, I explore, you know, much of my thinking around it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, gearing up for more books and working on start launching a web magazine, and you know, collaborating on some other projects. And yeah, that's kind of the stuff.
No,
I'm
we look
doing.
Forward to your web magazine. Well, I thank you so much for being a paradigm shifter, because we need to shift paradigms real fast, don't we, these days? And you're doing a lot of work on that, Daniel Pinchback.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate for having me on the show. And, you know, obviously people can follow me on Twitter, Daniel Pinchback, or Instagram or Facebook. I usually use my personal page. People can follow that. And, you know, check out the books on Amazon, When Plants Dream, Breaking Open the Head, How Soon Is Now, The Occult Control System. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's just been a delight. And I'm going to get into this occult control system, too. I'm going to learn all about that.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for, again, thank you for being a paradigm shifter. You too.
Bye.
Bye.